Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode number 297 of FilmWax Radio. Thank you for tuning into the show. If you're a subscribed member, I appreciate it especially. You get an extra special thank you. To those who are not subscribed, you have an opportunity to gain my further respect, indeed my worship, if you will. I worship my subscribers, and I would love to know that you were one of them. If you're listening right now, just go to iTunes and search FilmWax or FilmWax Radio, if you please, and just hit the subscribe button ever so gently and lovingly. Caress that button, you know? And then while you're there, leave a star rating, you know? It can't hurt, and I need it. I need them. And if you wanted to leave a comment as well. I'm getting distracted. The opening strains of music you heard were not arbitrary. That was William Fitzsimmons, who, I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a working singer-songwriter, tours relentlessly, maybe slightly less than he used to, because I know he's a dad now. So maybe he's pulled back a little bit, but he's always coming through New York City on his tours when there are the, you know, U.S. tours, of course. And I have been missing him the last bunch of years, but I just decided, as I've mentioned in recent episodes, that I'm going to start to interview some songwriters and musicians in addition to film people. And many of these musicians will probably have had songs and movies and soundtracks, etc., but I just don't want to limit myself, and I do want to talk to other people on occasion. I'm not going to make it a big thing. The overwhelming majority of people will continue to be people within the film industry as usual. That's what this podcast is pretty much about, as the name suggests. And so, you know, we'll continue doing that. But William is somebody who I've known over the years. I was introduced to his music by my ex-wife, actually. He was friends with some photographer that she knows, and I was listening to his music, and I kind of just ended up really getting attached to it. And then I saw him perform some years ago, and I kept going back, and I got his albums, and I was really enjoying it. The really, really whispered music, as you can tell, he's really a very mellow, chilled-out guy, but he's singing about pretty raw emotions. And when you see him live, it's a great experience. And so when I thought, let me see, who could I talk to in the music world that, you know, I would enjoy to talk to, and who's, you know, got a new CD, and it's called Pittsburgh, and available now, and he's touring. So let me talk to William. And so he was very generous and said, absolutely. And so we sat downstairs at City Winery here in New York City, and we had the conversation that you're going to hear in just a couple of minutes. So I hope as my listeners, you'll be a little patient and open-minded to it. I'm not that experienced, obviously, talking to musicians, but I am a musician, and I've grown up playing music and writing music, and so this was not something that was alien to me, but, you know, it was definitely using a new muscle set of muscles to talk to somebody in that with that kind of vernacular. So, but I think it came off pretty good. And I'm looking for other songwriters and musicians to talk to, again, just sort of sporadically. And I'm going to bring on some authors, but these are authors that write about film or filmmakers. The first one coming up in actually in just a couple of weeks is Josh Karp, who has a new book about Orson Welles called Orson Welles' Last Movie. And indeed, it is about the last film that Orson Welles made called The Other Side of the Wind. Josh wrote this book and reached out and to me on the over my website, and I've read it and I loved it. And this is a great book to talk to an author about. So we're going to bring on Josh shortly. And then I'm also looking into a couple of other authors. So bring in some musicians, bring in some comedians, bring in some authors on occasion. Don't freak out. This episode, number 297, we are bringing on William Fitzsimmons, as I mentioned, but we're also going to be talking to an editor, a film editor. His name is Zach Stewart Pontier, and I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's edited some pretty high-profile indie films, as well as the recent phenomenon that was The Jinx on HBO. That's him. He also has edited and done extensive work with these borderline guys, like Sean Durkin and Antonio Campos and all those. So Zach is going to be on this show to talk about his experiences. And finally, we're going to bring Larry Fessenden back to the show. What a treat. He had an acting role in this new horror film called We Are Still Here, directed by Ted Gahagan, who is also going to be joining us. And so and that's opening on Friday at the Cinema Village here in New York City and on demand. That's this show today, those three segments. So, and I'm proud, by the way, to also announce, very, very happy to, and I'll discuss it more in detail before the segment with Zach, but we have a new sponsor today that I'm introducing. The segment with Zach Stewart-Pontier is supported by EditStock.com, a place to download unedited film footage for people to practice editing with. Educational licenses for schools are available too. Download a free sample and start editing today. I'll talk to you a little bit more about that in just a little bit. But first, let's go into my conversation with singer, songwriter, musician, lovely man, William Fitzsimmons.
It's been
at least 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. easy. And I'll remind you, the first time was I met you because somebody introduced me to your music, and then I went made a point of going to see you. I had an opportunity to see you at like or the Canal Room or something. I can't remember.
The Canal Room.
Maybe that's what it was. Canal Room. And then some time later, it was like a significant amount of time. I came backstage at like Joe's Pub or something, and you remembered my name, which was very impressive. I thought, considering how many people you probably meet.
That was literally the only time
that's ever happened. Yeah, I don't know. Well, that's a compliment.
I mean, right?
Thank you very much. and that time, you may not remember, I was with Gail Marowitz.
Yeah, right. Who I love.
Yeah.
Very dearly.
Yeah. Well, she and I worked together at Sony Music for years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then we both, you know, had to move on.
Sure.
At a certain point. Yeah, yeah. And then I kind of disappeared from the music scene a little bit. But this is a big deal because I've been doing this podcast about film primarily. Mm-hmm. And I've done like close to 300 shows. It sounds like a lot, but it is. But this is the first time I'm bringing on a musician. You are the first guy. And I was
That's amazing. Thank you.
Yeah. No, I mean,
that's really cool.
I just thought, you know, it's a new muscle in a way for me to talk about music as opposed to film. But I said, so let me start with somebody I kind of feel like I think would make me feel comfortable and who I really have a familiarity with and whose music, you know, I've been following for a while. So thank you for doing it.
I'm honored.
Yeah. Did you remember the name at all or when you saw it maybe vaguely?
Well, here's the problem.
Yeah.
You said it immediately.
Right.
So
thousands and thousands.
Yes.
Now you're now, and you.
Well, no. Honestly, now. Yeah. No. I think I did. It would have been my first guess.
Mm-hmm.
Does that feel good?
Thank you.
It was my first guess.
Anyway, it doesn't even matter. Let's not waste time on that.
No.
But it's nice to have you.
No, but it. I mean, it does though in a way.
Yeah.
You know, there's a. You don't ever want to be so removed that doesn't matter. That's a bad place to be. I mean. If it's a matter of mathematics and age, and it's like, you know, I'm getting old enough to where I do start to forget every once in a while, but
of course,
no, you should care about people that are taking time to talk to you,
connect, and those types of things.
Connect.
It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So, how long have you been working?
10 years.
This is your 10th year doing it.
Yeah. 10 years, yeah.
Does that mean that's when you like released your first album, or does that mean when you said I'm doing this full time?
Well. The first album is 10 years. Deciding to do it full time is more like 8 years something. You know, because the early stuff for me was more of a like, oh, you know, it was something I wanted to do. There was no goal. There was no vision. It was just like, man, I've always wanted to do this. I always wanted to make a record, write songs. And, and I felt like I needed to do that just, from an emotional point of view. You know, it was a release for me.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as actually making that jump, I kind of held my feet in the water and out of the water for a couple of years. And
yeah.
It was like, I don't know, you know,
well, it's
scary.
Also not just a decision. You can just, I mean,
you can't, cause
you're not a working, I mean, it's not a living necessarily immediately unless you're lucky.
I'm going to be a working musician today.
There you go.
And it's going to be great. Yeah.
Yeah.
So no, it's absolutely beyond you. And that was a large part of the decision really was that I had kind of waited until, it was a measured decision. Like at the point that I made the choice, of course there was risk involved. There's risk involved today.
Right.
Know? But, it seemed like it was the right decision given all the information that was available to me.
10 years ago. I'm going to flash back to that time because that's about the time I lost my job in the music industry.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. It was right around the same time. And I wondered, given the reason I lost my job, which I was part of one of the several sweeps in a big distribution company.
Right.
Because it was obviously a tide of change was happening.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I guess, from your perspective, like getting started around that time. As
in
you
that
were,
whirlwind.
Like what were your thoughts then about figuring it out?
I was one of the few that was kind of benefited by that new paradigm of, music as kind of valueless, at least in a monetary way, buying a record was kind of an antiquated idea. And, but, the flip side of the coin is that all of a sudden, because it was so decentralized, you had a lot of people that could actually survive, like down at a lower level. Like you didn't need to sell a million records anymore to have a dedicated group of people that would support you entirely.
Are you glad that you didn't even have that? I don't know if you did, but I think you didn't have that big distribution experience. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I mean, I never really did. I mean, even, I release my records with labels now. It's no longer self-release and stuff, but it's a totally different thing for me. Like we're not after, at least I'm not, I'm sure the record label probably is, but I don't look at those numbers, because it kind of doesn't matter.
Right.
I mean, what would it change? It would change the bank account a little bit, but it shouldn't change my job at all. I'm trying to write songs that people can be helped by, feel a little bit less alone by. So as far as selling, like if I sell 5,000 records or 50,000 records, that's really cool. And it does feel good. Of course, if people are liking what you're doing, that's a wonderful compliment. But as far as when I'm sitting down with the guitar, writing a song, that has no influence, and it can't, or else I'm going in a bad direction.
Right. But you also have, like, at this point, a certain number of years in, you don't have to think, oh, is this commercial? Do I have to worry about that? That's not not much. In terms of the context of what other popular artists are doing and trends in the music industry,
right,
music
but there's
world,
still, yes.
Because
yes.
You've got, from the cycle of what you're doing, right? And you're touring and these are the clubs you're going to.
Right. But as far as the business side of it, to get people to stand behind it, it's become so much more aggressive in getting something that can really like capture attention, move units, because they don't have a choice, because they're trying to pay their rent, labels and managers, everybody else. So there is that. I mean, I think that pressure is more now for me than ever was before.
Right. That makes sense.
In a sense, it doesn't matter because I already have like a direct pipeline to people and they have a direct pipeline to me of, of fans that, know my catalog and they would probably search for it even if it was harder to find. So in that sense, it's great, but, there's still this really understandable, pressure to make something that can be digested really quickly and really easily.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that's okay. I mean, I understand that.
You mean like the people discovering you, or are you talking about just even people that have been following
No,
you?
I think it's more about discovery. It's more about increasing the
brand.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know. You've
exactly.
been resisting using the term.
I don't fault anybody for that because it's a difficult world and it's a difficult business. And,
right.
But, I've referenced it before. I have my specific job to do. And I'm really, really, I'm very, very religious about staying on that path. I really am because I feel like that's the only reason that I was given this opportunity. And that's the reason why people actually like my music. It's not because it's catchy or because it's interesting or complicated or whatever.
Can be all those things, but it's more than that. Yeah.
Right, right. But I mean, I think it's doing something emotionally. And,
definitely.
Yeah, I have to stay on that.
Yeah, that's how I found you too. I definitely felt like, wow, this guy is brave because you were singing, I mean, at least initially, it was this first album that I heard was about heartbreak.
Yeah.
You know, and well, we can all relate, but how many, it's also like we've seen and heard about heartbreak a lot. So to do that is also to say, I could still do something new and original and authentic on something that's been around and is a kind of universal thing that we've all heard before.
Yes. I want to do things that are like really honest.
Yeah.
To the point of like shame,
raw.
Honesty.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Super, super raw.
So you're not embarrassed.
No, not yeah. at all. And that right. was, that just comes, that comes from how I was raised, and maybe more so it comes from the work I did in the mental health field as a counselor. And I got really comfortable with talking about awful things that a lot of people don't want to talk about. And I like it, not as a masochist or something, or a sadist, but I like it because it's, you can get further in your relationships. You can get further with yourself when you're just laying it all out there and you're not putting up a sheen of BS, you know?
Yeah. Right. Slick. Slick kind of stuff. Well, you mentioned working in the mental health facility or hospital, or
I did inpatient for almost 5 years, and I did outpatient for about a year before I jumped into music full time.
Meaning, when outpatient, people that were
they were my clients.
Like,
individual
sorts.
Therapy. Exactly.
Oh, very good.
Right.
Is that where? So, did you go to school for social work or something?
No. I have a master's degree in mental health counseling.
Oh wow. Okay. So I don't know the backstory, and I can ask that now. Where did you go?
I love telling people that.
I love
because I'm
it.
Still paying the student loans. So
yeah.
I need to talk about it as much as possible. I went to Geneva College for my master's degree. Beaver
in
Falls.
Switzerland, of course.
Near Pittsburgh, actually, where I grew up.
Okay, yeah. So you grew up near Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. How far?
Geneva was like 30 minutes north of the city.
Okay,
like
is it which side is Falling Water on?
Oh, that's
about
further
30
out.
Minutes away.
That's
maybe a little bit more.
I think that's east.
Okay,
and I'm probably completely wrong. I've never actually went there.
Because I was actually we were kind of on this little retreatish weekend with this project I was working on, and we were talking about Pittsburgh because we were talking about first this one town where this guy was going was in the middle of upstate, and we were trying to figure out where the town was. Mm-hmm. Hamilton, New York, where Colby College is or something.
Okay.
You probably perform there. And then so we were talking about how, and then I go to Ithaca frequently because I have one of my best friends lives there. And so it's not like on the way, it's not right on the interstate or anything.
Right.
So you kind of have to be going there.
Yeah.
And like Pittsburgh is similar. Like usually it's not on the way to another city you're going to. It's, it's a bit out of the way. So you're going to Pittsburgh. So I've driven really far out of my way to go to Pittsburgh one time because I had not been there, and I wanted to see Pittsburgh and I wanted to see Falling Water a lot. Mm-hmm. And I did both of those things that on that trip. But,
it's a special city.
It is a great city, by the way.
Yeah. It is a special city. I care about it. It's what the new record is partially.
Is that true?
About it's called Pittsburgh, and
I don't see the connection. I'm
sorry. It's layered.
It's very subtle in that way.
Yeah, I don't know if a lot of people would get it, but
so is it nostalgic or is it nothing to do with that?
Yeah. I mean, it's what happened.
You must get
was,
there all the time.
I go back. All my family's still back there. I live in Illinois now, so it's a bit of a stretch to get there. But you know, when we'd go on tour or you know, when you holidays and things like that. And I love it. It means a lot to me. And I had a my grandmother died last year, and I went out, and it sort of inspired the whole reason for doing these songs now. I wanted to write a record about home for years, you know. But there was always another project that was kind of more in the forefront, and that experience of going back there for a few days, and you know, funerals are really hard, but there's a lot of good stuff that can come out of it with, you know, reconnecting with people you haven't seen for a long time, and maybe you even forgot about. And it was a pretty special trip, and it reminded me of a lot of the good stuff from that city. It's where I grew up, so there's obviously a lot of really awful memories there too, like anybody has, but.
When you were growing up there, when did you start playing guitar?
I was into music most of my life. I played the trombone and the piano when I was younger, and that didn't get me many girlfriends. Close to zero.
In between, was it like classical? Like you had to take classical piano? lessons?
Well, it was just, I mean, there was like a really sweet old lady in the neighborhood. My mom forced me to go to. And, you know.
Yeah. And you were probably restless sitting at the piano.
Yeah, I hated it. Really bad. It was terrible.
Yeah.
And then I did like trombone
and band.
Yeah, marching band.
The same thing.
The whole thing.
Had the same experience.
And that was actually fun. Yeah. I mean, cause I liked, like, I made a lot of really close friends doing band and traveling. Mm-hmm. And I didn't pick up a guitar until I was like 16 maybe. And I kind of fell in love with that pretty quick. But the whole time I was there, I never played any shows or I didn't do anything like that. Mm-hmm. That wasn't what I wanted out of music, really. I just liked sitting in my bedroom and like figuring out Led Zeppelin songs and like play. I would turn on like the classic rock, like WDVE in Pittsburgh was a classic rock station. I would turn that on and like find the volume where I could play, alongside it. Mm-hmm. And like it was loud enough to where I could really start to, you know, feel
like the way drummers play along with tracks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I could still hear the guitar and, you know, that was enough. That was so much fun. I got a lot of enjoyment about that. It wasn't until I was later and more screwed up that I actually wanted to write songs and felt like I had something to add to the billion popular songs made.
I know it's a very probably typical question, but I can't help but ask if you had any particular guys you were listening to, you know.
Well, I grew up with all the, like, I grew up with Simon and Garfunkel and Joni Mitchell. My mom was totally into folk and like light folk. So there was also some like
Bread.
There was Bread, Peter, Paul, and Mary, you know, 60s and the 70s stuff.
Yeah,
and
John
Denver.
Gordon Lightfoot.
We listened to that a lot. Yeah, she never got into Gordon Lightfoot, which was cool. I'm like happy that nothing against
Gordon. Because then it was something
light
music.
Yeah. But yeah, so that was what I spent most of my childhood with. And then in high school, of course, I totally got into like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and Bob Seger and Led Zeppelin and much more the classic rock thing.
Yeah.
But I kind of, my heart never really, that was so much fun. Like when you figure out Ramble On the acoustic guitar, you know, it's so much fun. But I never really felt anything when I was playing those songs. It was just nothing but fun.
Right.
But it wasn't until I started kind of returning to those old records that my mom always used to play. So all of a sudden I was like, whoa, this is different. I'm, you know, 'cause I was growing up and I started to understand sadness a little more and loss and longing and all those more grown up emotions. And that stuff was not being talked about in classic rock in a way that I understood. Mm-hmm. But when I listened to, you know, like Nick Drake for the first time, I was like, whoa, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to make people feel the way that I feel right now.
Hmm. Pink Moon.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Really? Yeah.
Favorite record.
Was it at that point you started meeting girls? Because you mentioned before.
Yeah. Ironically, that was a big, that was a really big reason why I did pick up the guitar. It was because, you know.
It's a long tradition.
Or
just, you know,
sometimes
on a level.
Sometimes it works, you know.
Sure. But it's also a way to, if you're shy or if, I mean, everybody's shy and social and awkward on some level.
No, but some a lot more than others.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What you were going to say. I
don't know. It's just a way to, you know, as we started talking about connecting.
So, yeah. It gets you into situations where you can actually talk to other people and not be terrified. And I had the biggest crush on this one girl. And, you know, and I thought that somehow I could impress her by like playing guitar at youth group or something like that. And she would totally just want to go out with me, you know. And the truth is I fell so much in love with playing the acoustic guitar that I started like not leaving my room very much and not even like in an unhealthy way. I was so fulfilled falling asleep, you know, playing guitar. Like my mom and my brother used to have to come in and take the guitar off my stomach so it wouldn't, when I rolled over, you know, it wouldn't like fall on the floor or something. And it remains a great passion. I love it. I love it so much. And it feels like a guitar feels like a part of my body. If that doesn't
sound too
creepy.
Do you take breaks from it though? I mean, no.
I mean, really seldomly, but I start to get kind of itchy if it's if it's too long. It's definitely good to put it down. Like, I have kids now, and you...
Oh, you do.
You know, and they, like, tell me to put it down. You're like, Daddy, don't play guitar. I want to cuddle with you. I'm like, okay.
That's a... Yeah, that's a kind of a...
That sounds
great. That's a good one. That's a good strategy.
She knows what she's doing. Yeah, yeah. She's really sharp about that, but...
Just about anybody who phrases it that way, it'll probably work.
There's very few... Yeah.
Anybody sort of says, I want to cuddle with you, please put down the guitar, you probably...
I mean, if it was like...
Your grandfather. You know,
if it was some guy that I never saw before, I probably would say, like,
might be paused before you do it.
I might still do it.
Have you always been a solo, I guess it's like a troubadour kind of thing. It's like, have you had a band?
Often. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I have a band.
Because every time I've seen you, well, I can't say every time. I can stick around tonight, if they don't kick me out, it'll be my, I guess, third, maybe fourth time.
I like to alternate a lot. That's the thing that I found. From doing it, you know, definitely for the first couple of years, just because I didn't know anyone, I couldn't have afforded to pay anybody to play with me. But after a while, I found some guys maybe they're opening for you or you're opening for them or any number of things. You tend to meet musicians when you do this enough. Mm-hmm. And, I've developed some really close friendships, and I have guys that I've played with now for, you know, 5-6 years. Mm-hmm. And we switch on and off. You know, we'll go overseas and we'll play a full band tour or play festivals and stuff. And then, you know, the next time I go through, I'll just bring a couple guitars and just be me up there.
I can see how that would be nice to alternate. I mean, there's obviously things you can do in either of those situations that you can't do in the other. Both have their advantages in a way.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, totally. And disadvantages. I think it's really bad if you just do the same thing all the time. It's bad for an audience. Because it just gets so stagnant, and it's bad for you because you're not challenging yourself, you know, in a new situation. Like, guys that have bands that never play solo ever, they're missing out on this amazing intimacy that can happen. It can fall flat too.
Yeah.
But, and vice versa. You know, when I first went up there with the band, it was a nightmare. I couldn't hear myself.
Right.
I was like going nuts because I produced I produced first two records myself. So, I'd never even heard anybody trying to play one of my songs.
Right.
And they were doing great, you know, but I was so put off by it.
Yeah. Because in the studio, you're obviously doing it one track at a time.
One track at a time.
You don't have that experience. And then you have to kind of recreate it live, which is not always easy because that's a new dip. Maybe you don't even try to do it. Maybe try to do something a little close.
I have great band members and I let them do their job. And I do mine. I write the songs and then they rehearse them. Mm-hmm. And I usually give them a lot of latitude in what parts they're going to play. And, you know, usually you're ballparking the record anyways, but I say to them before every rehearsal, before every tour, like, I want you guys to play what you want to play. Cause you got to keep them engaged and fresh.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, cause that's a part of the energy that's being dispersed to an audience. And if they're up there going through the motions, it ain't gonna happen, man. The magic's not gonna be there no matter what.
Yeah. Is there a sort of a recipe? Like, do you go, like, you're writing the songs on your own? Or do you, my question, I guess, is, does the song evolve after you introduce it to the band? And then all of a sudden they're all now contributing their ideas. And so are you actually, like, playing live through some of that? Or is that all done in the studio? Or,
By the time we're at the end of a tour, I'd say that some of the songs.
And then you go into the studio?
What's that?
And then you go into the studio at the end of a tour?
Or
you
do
have to support the album, right? So.
Yeah. I mean, we've done stuff where we've looked for opportunities to do some recorded radio session stuff, mm-hmm. just so we have a document of how we sounded at the beginning and the end, mm-hmm. and things like that. And invariably it does change, you know, some to differing degrees. Some songs are almost the same, but some can be, I mean, there was one song off the last record that it started out just exactly like the record. And by the time we were done, it was like completely turned on its head, totally different tempo, different feel. And that was just because we remained open to what the song was calling for.
Cause I'm wondering, like, if you're recording this, you write it and then alone, mm-hmm. and then you record it with the band. I understand there's obviously that. Then there's like a,
right.
You know, it evolves a bit. And then you're recording then you go to record. Oh, you're recording it, and then you go tour with the band.
Right.
That makes sense, that trajectory, you know, that kind of...
Yeah.
I don't know how much... Hey, Mario, how much time do we have? We're good? Okay. Because I'm going to ask him to play a song from the new album, too, at some point.
Yeah.
Thanks, by the way. That's Mario, the tour manager?
Yeah.
Okay.
The best.
Where are you based now, by the way?
Central Illinois.
You are? Okay.
It's wonderful.
How'd you end up there?
My wife's family's all from there.
Yeah.
I love it.
You do?
It's quiet. It's a wonderful place to raise children. Mm-hmm. And I have a little studio in the attic. It's perfect. And I get to, you know, I always tell people that I get to see anywhere that I mean, that sounds really awful, but I get to see anywhere I want to. No, I mean, I like traveling. I love touring. Mm-hmm. And I don't ever want to like have that craziness at home, because home is already crazy enough on its own. And mm-hmm. I like just being, you know, just being dad mm-hmm. at home and not worrying about all that other stuff. And that helps me write better too, because it's separated from performance and, you know, any other thing that comes from doing the job that I do. And you don't have to be anywhere anymore. Like, guys are making records in closets in like Scottsdale, Arizona right now that everyone's going to think are the best record.
So. I wondered what was going on at Scottsdale, because...
Well, that's literally it, though. Past that, there's nothing else. But, and it's great, you know? And I love that. I love not having to live in, you know, a destination.
When you have the songs, mm-hmm. I mean, are you waiting till you have 15 songs or 20? I don't know how it works, but do you have like a... And then you call the musicians in, or do you go and travel?
It all depends. I mean, like this one I did all by myself.
Oh, you did?
I just did the whole thing.
Okay. I haven't heard it yet. So
that's okay. There's one song that was like begging me. The song itself was for a cello part. So I got in touch with somebody down in Nashville, but, no, usually I actually like to do the satellite stuff anymore, just cause it ends up being really, it's a lot easier for everybody. Like, I'll call my drummer and I'll be like, hey man, I'm going to send you a song and
I see.
Let me know what you think. And okay. Cause he's got his own space and
he can just do it.
He
remotely.
Can do it in his comfortable space that he knows every inch of it.
Yeah.
He can eat his bowl of cereal in the morning.
And you're looping stuff too, so often.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a lot of fun. Now, I mean, there's times when you do need to be in the room together mm-hmm. or else there's something missing, but, you know, you can do so much that way, just bouncing ideas back and forth. And, like the Postal Service is kind of the classic example of that,
where them.
That record was literally made by sending each other, you know, song ideas and tracks. And it makes something really cool.
Of course, now it's a classic. Or
it's a classic. It's, I mean, it is.
One of the great albums. It's not so good. I guess it's at least 12, 13 years old already, isn't
it? It's not that old, but he just did that, you know, he just did that tour. Mm-hmm. It was like arenas and everything. He's playing to these massive audiences. I mean, they haven't done any new music. There's no new records.
Did they just kind of come out and do like a reunion, or rather a
it's just a
anniversary?
Tour. It's like just
and they just played the album again,
and it went nuts. You know, I mean, because people love that record so much, and it just kind of had this. It's one of those fun things where it just had this amazing build where all of a sudden it just kept spreading and spreading. Everybody knew it. You know?
Speaking of that, you know, God, I realize just how many questions I have about
that. Right. I like it.
Cause you're other, like I said, you're the first touring musician I have had on this podcast I do. But Bertolucci's been on, by the way, so, and Brian De Palma.
Kidding.
And Ken Burns and a lot of other people. So
that's awesome.
But have you contributed to an album? You've contributed to a soundtrack, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
right. Of course. That's, I think.
It's been a lot more television stuff.
And, right.
But there's been several things overseas, believe it or not.
I believe
like
it.
Like foreign language films and stuff. But there's been a few here mm-hmm. in the States. I like movies a lot. And mm-hmm. I particularly have discovered a lot of the music that I care about because of their connection with a film. I'm thinking of, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson movies or Wes Anderson.
Don't know them.
You know, I didn't. Yeah. I'm certain. And you know, I love just the gestalt that takes place uh-huh. whenever you're using beautiful images and performances and putting beautiful music aside it, you get this effect that is so much bigger than any single piece involved in it.
Yeah,
and like when my music is involved in something like that, it's it's actually, it's pretty special for me.
I can't imagine. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but a lot of people act cool about that stuff. So, like, yeah, whatever. But I think it's really neat, man. I love that. You know?
Yeah, I bet. And your music definitely, I could see why it would lend it, because it is so emotional.
Yeah,
it's raw, emotionally raw, and it's
it helps to communicate.
Yeah.
I think what the director or the producer is trying to get across.
Yeah, know? That's well said. I have to, So when you before you're going to play something from, would you do that?
Yeah,
like we
yeah.
can use these mics for other things too. Like
sure.
That'd be great. Maybe something from the new album.
Yeah,
and I see there's a couple of guitars around here. Yeah. We're at the City Winery, where we're recording this downstairs in sort of their green room, I guess. And you know, I'll ask you just like also, I guess afterwards about how it is, you know, especially at places like this. And you were talking earlier about your brand in a way, and I imagine the festivals and the venues you play is part of that, like how you build that audience, because you're playing at this club or that festival as opposed to the other ones, and they so know people know how, that if they go to that they'll probably like you or
of course
right
yeah you can't yeah you have to think about it just enough and then you have to not think about it. At all.
Well said, yeah.
It's a really...
It's just, I'm always interested in that because I have to deal with that too.
Of course.
So I'm interested in how it is from the, like, kind of your dimension, your perspective, you know, because...
There's a time and a place to say no.
Yeah.
You know, there's an art in saying no, not to be a douche or something, but because, you know, because you care about where your art ends up, you know. But you also have to recognize, man, that once it's out of your mouth... Like, you can't control how it's disseminated, really, or how people are going to respond to it.
Sure.
You can't worry about it. You just have to do the best you can and then say, well.
Makes sense.
Hope it goes good, you know.
All right. So what we're going to do is you're going to play a song from the new album. It's called Pittsburgh. And it is currently, right? It's available, right?
It is.
I can hold that, too. But I was going to also... So what's the name of the song?
So this is called Ghosts of Penn Hills off the new record called Pittsburgh.
Could I please have a minute to catch my breath? Everyone that I love has been left behind. Not the kind who would tend to believe in ghosts, but I see them every night. Had a dream that I was just a boy again, and my father was young and still full of time. Now my grandmother's body is in the earth, but I see her every night. I will love you till the ghost of these Penn Hills will bring me. I was woke by the baby at 5 a.m. Found out a day later that's when you left. that it's true that we'll meet again. And I'll tell my girls your name. But I miss you all the same.
Very moved by that. Yeah. I mean, what a gift to be able to do that and, like, you know, for your grandma and, you know, to be able to relay that to people over time. And
I owe her a lot. And it was, there's a line from, I'm going to butcher it. I think it's a Mark Kozelek song. And it's, no, it's not. No, I'm totally wrong. This is embarrassing. It's Tim McGraw. You don't have to edit that. I'll live with the embarrassment of that.
can you?
No, but it's my old friend. I apologize. What is it? A few simple verses were the least that I could do to tell the world you were here. And that was a really heartbreaking line for me to hear. And I thought about that line whenever my grandma passed. And it's such a... It's really a trite act in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, here's a record about my grandma dying. And I totally get that. And I felt a little bit weird about doing it because of that. But I also felt like, it was something that I could do that even in a little small way, was a recognition that she meant something to me, you know, and had an effect on me. She was the reason that my mom ended up playing music and my mom taught me. And, you know, so there was that lineage of music that I thought would be neat to recognize, too.
The struggle of what you're talking about is, it seems like that's the dilemma of the performer artist, because you're an artist, but then you have to perform it. Yeah. And there's where you have to make those kinds of, you know,
and
ethical and emotional decisions. Yeah. And entertain.
And find a way to entertain with really, sometimes devastating material. You know?
Yeah.
It's tricky, but I like it. It's fun. Yeah, it's fun to dance with that.
People can go to williamfitzsimmons.com.
Totally, I own it.
It's good. Glad you do.
Domain.
I'm glad you do.
And it was like 5 minutes from being a just hardcore porn site, but I swept in and grabbed.
It's probably why I haven't come across it.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, the williamfitzsimmons.com, and we'll put that link there. You know, of course, up. Yeah. And thanks for being my first musician on the show.
I love it.
It was
Thank you.
Totally the best decision I've made in a long time.
Thanks for having
and
me.
And I'm going to try to sneak in upstairs to hear all the songs that you're going to play. And I have to confess one last thing, and that is that at some point early on, and I'll send you a link if you'll give me an email or something, but that off of Derivatives, I think, which was the remix album, right?
Yeah,
was
your, that's right.
I stole a bit snow. I'm finally able to admit it to you. For a long time,
confession.
I used the snippet in my intro, like for my. I just used it.
I'm very happy
for a long time. Yeah, and I was thinking I got to eventually let him know. I have it now. I have different music, but currently,
I am forgiving you. Okay. Of all.
None of those were sold.
It's
okay.
You're totally fine.
All right. So, well, thanks a million.
Thanks so much.
All right, as we go into my segment with Zach, Stuart Ponter, who's at the young age of 32, he's already edited an amazing number of contemporary classics, let's call them that, including Catfish, New York Export, Opus Jazz. Zach edited it. Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, incredible, Sean Durkin's film. Simon Killer we had on, of course, Antonio Campos and Brady Corbet, who talked some couple of years ago, and Zach Now, who's the editor on it, and most recently, The Jinx, The Life and the Deaths of Robert Durst, which, you know, the court cases, of course, is just ongoing, or the court cases are ongoing. So we're going to talk about all that with Zachary. But I first wanted to introduce my new sponsor. The name of this is Edit Stock. I'm very excited. I think this is an exceptional product. You can find it if you go to their website, edstock.com. Well, practice is much more important than talent, especially with creative skills. It takes practice to get good at anything creative. Between 30 and 50% of every purchase that you make at EditStock is paid in commission to the filmmaker who owns the footage. That means EditStock is paying indie filmmakers to keep creating. It's an amazing cycle of success. These are not Hollywood big shots. They're talented people making personal projects available for others to learn with. It's beautiful. EditStock is a safe place for everyone to try editing out. That means assistant editors trying to move up, editors switching genres, people to learning edit, to new to editing, brand new people new to editing, hobbyists, technicians, and everyone in between. EditStock is a safe place to practice and improve before putting yourself in front of a paying client. Edit Stock footage can be used on your own demo reel. Use the discount code FILMWAX at checkout. You'll get a special 10% discount off your first purchase on editstock.com. What a great service, and I'm very excited. I hope that this is the beginning of a long relationship with this wonderful company. And so in order to celebrate this occasion, here it is, my conversation with editor Zach Stewart Pontier. The new Maisel's, either of the new two, his final two films.
I haven't.
You're so busy working, but
yeah, there's a lot to catch up on for sure. I really want to see him.
Well, Iris is out.
Yeah.
So I mean that'll be out. And I don't know if it's online yet either. If they released it that way, and then the Transit project, which he was involved with, and he talks about in that interview, if you remember.
Yeah.
You know, and now finally that came. That was at Tribeca, and I actually saw it. They have an online library during the festival
right. For
press and industry. So I actually, it was the last day of the festival, and I was so exhausted. I decided to stay home and watch stuff on there,
yeah. You
know, because
yeah.
I was supposed to go in to see my friend's film, but I just, it was available also on the online library. So I watched it and watched like five things that day on the online library. And In Transit was one of them. It was really, it's a good film. It's just, you know, I clearly the result of a larger collaboration, you know.
Sure. How many people did they end up following?
I think there were about, I don't know, you know, it's like the meandering thing. So it's not like chapters per se. So it's just, there are at least half dozen of people in you know, in that film that were kind of telling their stories. And it was a good, well-edited, well-made project. But for everybody listening, I'm welcoming Zach. And it's, do you go by Stuart, your full name? Stuart Pontier?
Yeah.
Okay. Zach Stuart Pontier, the film editor. Most recently, obviously, your career is probably more on people's radar because, if not before, because of The Jinx.
Yes.
I mean, that was a huge thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were lucky in that sense that a lot of people saw it.
How'd that come about?
The Jinx?
Mm-hmm.
My involvement in The Jinx?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I had worked with Mark and Andrew. They came in to produce Catfish. So we knew each other based on working together on that film. And
okay.
When they had done the first interview with Bob around 2010. You want me to shut the window?
Oh, it's yeah, sure. I guess you know it's part of the soundtrack of the podcast because it's a New York podcast. But and we're being joined today by your two pups here, right?
That's right, Madeline and Bailey.
Madeline and Bailey, they're adorable French bulldogs.
Yeah. So They had done the original interview with Bob after All Good Things was about to come out. And so they were kind of shopping that around as a standalone
That piece. was the fiction, the narrative version of The Jinx, right?
That's correct, yeah. That Mark had written and Andrew had directed.
Andrew Jarecki. Mark
Smirling.
He's the screenwriter?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And producer. Okay. And so they had done that original interview with Bob, which makes up much of The Jinx. That's sort of the backbone of much of that series. And so they brought me on. They had this sort of 40-minute piece that they had cut that they were shopping around to put on TV, and everybody was sort of like, it's obviously a much bigger story. And so they hired me, and for a long time we were trying to make a feature-length documentary out of that story.
I see. But it grew into a larger than a feature length.
Yeah, it was an interesting experience that as we were trying to cut it down, it sort of got worse. You know, usually it's hard to cut these things down, but you do it and it gets better and you're like, well,
What you find?
Do you find
that too many projects are cut down for theatrical that maybe should be, that could have been, it's a missed opportunity, they could have been something more fleshed out? I'm not saying whether there's a commercial appetite or if that's a successful way to go, that's a whole other conversation. But
I do feel like there are certain stories that need to be told at longer than feature length.
Serially.
Sure, definitely. But I think more so there's stories that should be shorts that end up being feature length documentaries.
I totally see that.
I see that a lot.
Especially with documentaries.
Yeah, and you're like, this could be a fantastic 30-minute piece, and right. Should be, you right. know, and yeah. why it's like now we're 45 minutes in and we're like, all right,
again, commercial pressures. I mean, I think probably lots of documentary filmmakers know that, but you know, because they're trying to get into festivals, and shorts are extremely, as hard as it is to get a feature length film, and it's easier than getting a short anywhere.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. But now that, I mean, hopefully now with all the different sort of platforms going on, that there is more of a market for things that are shorter. And I mean, I think online there's been I've seen a lot of more great short documentaries online. So I think that's
good.
Where
do you see them? I mean,
passed along through by friends mostly, like Vimeo, staff picks and stuff like that. I don't know.
Right. Well, Vimeo on demand, sure. And also Fandor, which is a regular sponsor of the show. I'm not plugging them just arbitrarily, but it makes sense to talk about it because they do have tons of shorts on there. I mean, it's a subscription-based service, but there's no other... I don't think subscription-based service that shows shorts or that many, and that, you know, unless I'm mistaken, I don't know where you see shorts. There must be other sites that show shorts, but...
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, yes. So I do think different stories at different lengths, I mean... Mm-hmm. So with this story, obviously, it wasn't going to... It didn't work. We had like a 4-hour cut, then we had a 3-hour cut, and it sort of started to lose its magic in a way. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of the story, the magic's in the details and having the time to unspiral these you know, three different mysteries over 30 years. So yeah,
three murders.
He was tried for murder in Galveston
in 2004,
from murder in 2001. Uh-huh. And he was found not guilty.
Right.
And then there was the, you know, disappearance of his wife.
Right.
In 1982 in New York, and that's never been solved.
Right.
And then he's recently been charged, and then murder of Susan Berman.
So you get indicted, and then after being charged? How does that work? Do you know?
Do you even know?
It doesn't matter.
I don't know.
But the trial's yet to happen.
Yes.
Okay, so, and we'll see what happens with that. But that's quite a... So let's now that we know where, and also what's in the other recent films that you're on.
I edited Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene.
Right.
So you kind of like edited Simon Killer.
Antonio and Brady Corbet were on the show.
Oh, awesome.
That's one I'll, if you haven't heard that, right around the time Simon Killer came out. I would love to bring on some of the other fellows. You know, I know some of them are. So let's talk about that too.
Yeah.
I just love that. I've been enjoying all those films. And there's a new one coming out. I know.
James White. Josh Mann's directorial debut. It's very good. It's incredible.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you edit that?
I did not edit that. I was sort of consulting with them, but a very talented editor. cut that.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
They just seem to sort of created something very exciting, right? How did that come about? Can you talk a little bit about Borderline? I would love to bring on some more of those guys, certainly.
Yeah, well, you should.
Sean and all those fellows. Yeah, so I should do a segment just on Borderline.
That would be awesome.
You know.
That'd be great. You should do that. We were all – I met first Sean and Josh. We were in our sophomore 16mm film class together at NYU.
Okay. So that whole gang is from NYU. Or some of them.
So Josh, Antonio, and Sean all went to NYU. And
Josh is?
Josh Mond. Antonio Mond. Campos and Sean Durkin went to NYU. And also Jody Lee Lipes was a year ahead of us.
I did a thing with him, too. I'm sorry to keep plugging myself.
No, you should.
Forgive me, Zach. Well, this may not even make it in there, frankly. And if something emergency happens, just answer the phone. He didn't do the podcast per se, but he did this TV thing I do out of Brooklyn occasionally. Like I do, I'm rotating to host, and I wanted Jody on for ballet,
422.
422, yeah. He's such a talented, great guy.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah, so, continue, I mean, please, NYU, the best thing about it.
By the way? Sorry.
I graduated in 2006.
Okay.
I think Jody graduated in 2005, but I'm not sure.
So it's mid-decade there where this whole gang was there and graduated.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just to get a context.
So we, tons of other talented people as well. Lance Edmonds was there at the time.
Wow.
And
okay.
Kyle Martin and Alicia Vancouvering.
Yeah.
So it was a good crew of people to be introduced to and to sort of come up together. And we were all making music videos and short films right out of college and, working on each other's stuff. And then the first feature that we all worked on together was called After School. And I was the assistant director on that. That's what I was doing for a while. I was assistant directing and also did some additional editing for that.
So when you're at NYU, and was this undergrad or graduate?
Undergrad.
You're all editing there too, right? Or it's part of the curriculum?
Yeah, I mean, everybody's sort of wearing a lot of hats.
Is that a requirement for the
editing?
Degree?
No, I don't. Okay. I think you could probably make it through without doing any editing if that was what you're.
But you did.
No, I did not.
I
fell into editing there.
Afterwards?
There.
Oh, in NYU.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were definitely. Was that something you thought about? Like, is like an intrinsic part of your career?
I really fell into it. I mean, a friend of mine had made a film, and I was just helping him out editing it. We were editing it together, really, and he was the writer, producer, director. And so when he was doing the credits, he was like, "You know what? I'm just going to give you the editing. I'm not going to take this editing credit." And I was like, "Okay." And I was making my short film at the time, and we found out that I had won this like editing craft award. And I was like, "Oh, that's kind of weird. You know,
maybe I'm an editor.
Maybe I'm good at this. Like, maybe I should look into this." And so then another person was like, "Oh, I saw you edited that film. Will you edit my film?" And so I started working on other people's films, and I really enjoyed it because, film school, if you're making a film, basically you're paying for it. So if somebody else is making the film, they're paying for it. So I was able to touch a lot of things and be involved in telling a lot of stories, and it was good, really good, great practice for me.
Is there a freedom with that?
A freedom, how so?
I don't know, just like the realizing, I can just, I could be an editor for hire. Is that a liberty, more freeing than being responsible for the film?
I guess so. I mean, I think it was the challenge for me. I enjoyed the puzzle of it and having the constraints of this is footage that somebody else shot. You weren't involved in that. And now you're supposed to take it and be creative with the way that you use this footage. I really liked that. I liked helping other people tell their stories and being able to, that was shot for this reason. Well, let's use it for this reason. I mean, the first few times you do that as an editor and it works, it's like, I mean, it's still magic to me on some level when you're able to take some scene or shot and in the edit room by sort of flipping it and reverse engineering it. Oh my God, now it looks like she's looking at the cookie and now she's hungry and everything's solved, The first few times that happens,
tricks.
Very exciting.
They feel, yeah, yeah.
I don't know, tricks, but...
Tools.
Tools. Yeah. And so I started to really love it. And as I was getting involved more with the Borderline guys and more with other people, I decided not to make a senior thesis and just to work on as many projects as possible. And my goal was to be able to leave school with like a very good reel, editing reel. And so that was what I tried to do.
Mm-hmm. did you at certain point then, as a sort of now self-identifying as a, sure. an editor, did you go back and look at other editors, like their techniques and their, there were there editors that, or you just hit the ground running on a certain level? And
that's a good question. There's definitely editors that inspired me, mm-hmm. or movies that inspired me. But I think to me it was more about learning that whatever the film called for was the thing to do, mm-hmm. you know, and to try to be styleless. I mean, I feel like as an editor,
your idea is to remove yourself from.
Yeah, I don't think if you're recognizing, mm-hmm. oh, so and so cut that. It's a, I think that's a problem. You know, so I
are there any examples that you can think of where you know who the editor is? I don't. Again,
I don't want to.
Oh, it's true. That would be putting you on the spot.
Negative,
examples. Well, somebody. Of, this, well, your negative might be somebody else's positive too.
Sure.
Some people enjoy that too, or because there is also a school of thought that you know you shouldn't know who the director is too. But it's
that may be.
You know, but we clearly can identify certain directors.
Totally. I guess what I mean is just that the style should just be trying to tell the story well. And that's what I like to focus on.
A good way of putting it. Very diplomatic of you, I should say. So, so you mentioned Catfish, also Ariel Schulman.
Schulman. Yeah, he was also at NYU.
Right. Mm-hmm. And
Henry Joost.
And Henry Joost, those guys. Another, yeah.
So actually, I met them originally through Jody. So I was working on, you know, these borderline short films and features and then Jody was sort of the connective tissue when mm-hmm. we were all making, and then we all worked on Opus Jazz together.
Oh, right.
That's so we did that film together.
Project. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's how I met Henry Joost and Ariel Schulman.
Oh, okay. I got to go back and look at that again.
They recently played that.
They showed it, I'm sure you know it. It was a night at BAM. They showed it. That's right. That's what he came out. He was talking about. Okay, so did you edit, or you were an AD on Catfish?
I edited Catfish.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you did.
And co-produced Catfish.
Okay, very good.
I edited Opus Jazz.
Did that film catch you by surprise? Like
Catfish?
Just the level of the controversy that came out of that since you were there? You were in the trenches?
Which were the controversy about whether or not it was real or not?
Yeah.
That did catch me by surprise completely. The first time I even heard that somebody didn't believe it, the film was already like, you know, it was like an hour and a half long or an hour and 45 minutes mm-hmm. long. And I showed it to a friend of mine. He said, "This isn't true." And I said, "What are you talking about? That's insane. Like, this is, of course this is true." Mm-hmm. And, that was the first time I heard it. And I was, nobody else. He's like, "That's what people are going to think." And I thought, "Nobody's going to think that. That's crazy." And then sure enough, we went to Sundance and everybody thought it was fake.
Hmm. Did the people at Sundance think it was fake?
I don't know. I think they were nervous about it because we were not in the documentary section per se. I think we were in the premieres section or one of their other sections.
Yeah, a loophole section.
Yeah, but it was listed as a documentary in
everywhere.
That section.
But, of course.
And it is a documentary, uh-huh. and it's totally...
You stand by it.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I mean, it's interesting that people think it's fake, and I think what people really are talking about when mm-hmm. they say this is faked, I think they're talking about that first act. Where he's seemingly he's falling for this stuff, and the big question I always hear is like, why would they film that? Why? How could he have not known? I mean, I think once it gets to the woman and the sons, and spoiler alert, but at the end,
I think by now, there's clearly enough time has gone by where most everybody knows the ending of that film and all the pieces of it.
Sure.
You know,
Statute
of limitations.
On spoilers, we're good. Okay. Yeah. So at the end of that film, I mean, I think nobody's... I haven't heard anybody question the veracity of the very end of the film just because it's so real. But so anyway, I think on the level of the beginning of the film, it's interesting because there was some skepticism in some of those scenes that was removed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So there's... I think I had like 8 scenes or 9 scenes that were shot before they went, and they were absolutely shot before they went, and Neve did not know what was going on. Mm-hmm. But there was, you know, Henry was one of the more skeptical people, and so there was scenes where he was like, "Are you sure? How do you know? Are you sure? Blah, blah, blah." And we had those.
Are you sure that she's
that
the
she's
real...
who she says she is? Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we had those scenes in the film for a while, and people would say, people would see the film, and you got to take those scenes out. I don't want to be thinking about that. I want to be along for the ride, you know. Mm. And so
we want to be with him.
We want to be on love. We want to believe that these people are in love, which makes sense.
Right? You know? It's an editing, you know, decision. It's an editing. It's very much a great example of what an editor has to grapple with. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So to me, it's like once we remove those scenes, now it's interesting that people look at it and they say, well, what about this? Because you didn't show me skepticism, that means the whole thing is fake. I think that's...
Oh, I see.
I think
then
that's
you're
why.
Stuck with the other side.
Exactly.
Double-edged sword.
Exactly.
You can't win.
I think the choices that we made were good ones because it brought the audience more on the ride. And that was the idea. You know, it's better... It's a better journey if you're more on the ride of these guys. These people might be in love, and then you find out later. And so I think that's editing. You're sort of creating this journey for the audience, and it was true. It is true. Those feelings that he had were true. You know what I mean? So that's. I think it would have been a mis. I would have felt really uncomfortable if we were faking scenes in the beginning. That would have felt weird to me. Mm-hmm. But making editing decisions to heighten one thing or another is editing.
In a project like that, you were there from the beginning? Or
they called me from Michigan on the way back.
Oh, they did? Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah.
So it was done. It was sort of gotcha.
Clearly the film was done. Yeah. But are there other examples where you're part of the core team from the beginning? And then, like, you know, my friend who hooked us up, Michael Taylor, often works, like, on the set. Because they can actually start to assemble the film in real time, sort of on the go, which can be helpful, I suppose, in certain situations.
Absolutely. I mean, with the example of a scripted film, I was definitely cutting Marcy, me and Marlene while they were shooting.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to show them, and that was really helpful for that film, which is going back and forth in time. They shot all the stuff in the past first, and then they moved to the present. So we had a string out of the past that Sean could watch and look at, and that was very helpful in terms of for him to be able to line up these moments of transition that I think make the film so special. I mean, there's a lot of things about that film that are really special, but that's one of my favorite things about it.
It opens up so many questions. You know, one is, like, yeah, that type of thing where it's a tricky structure because of the time frame, and then how it jumps back and forth, and, you know, and how you arrive at that, and how much more complicated a project that is than perhaps something that's more linear in nature.
Well, I would say with that film, that was the script.
The
if you look at the script, that's the concept of the film, is that it's this woman who's sort of caught between these two worlds, and as the audience, we're kind of caught there we're stuck there with her in this sort of transitional state, and that was always the case. But it was interesting what we found in the edit room when we laid out and assembled the film as it was written in the script, was that it was bouncing back and forth too quickly, and that it was becoming hard to follow, and that it was much more pleasing for the audience, at least at first, to spend more time in each place. And so we sort of, you know, in the film is a weave. The film is like weaving between these two storylines together. So we separated them at a certain point in the edit, and we strung them out, and we watched them individually, and we sort of, and then we wove them back together.
Interesting.
And a lot of the stuff stayed, you know, but a few things here and there didn't. And a few,
again, the assembly changed.
Exactly. Yeah. So a lot of the transitions were ones that were scripted to be these moments back and forth, and then there were a few that we found just in the edit room.
It's a film, now that I think about it, where, yeah, I've seen there are a lot of examples of films that play with that, go back and forth of time, and some do better than others, and I know I've been in certain watching certain films and have preferred, had like kind of a preference for one of those time zones, time frames is a better way of, not zones, time frames, like, you know, like, oh, good, we're back in the, you know, in the present, but the Marcy May Marlene was an example where, and I'm going to edit that, by the way, so it sounds perfect. where I really enjoyed being in both time frames. It's a really compelling film of its time.
Well, to me, it's amazing because they're not really flashbacks. They're flash presence. You know what I mean? Like, she is always experiencing what you're seeing. You're not seeing it just for the sake of plot or just for the sake of, like, revealing information. Though it does those things. It does push the story forward and it does reveal information. But
it's her point of view.
So, in other words,
when she's flashback, she's having a... She's remembering. She's having a memory.
Exactly.
And And it's impacting her present time.
Yeah.
Those memories, how she behaves and responds.
Right. And I think that's what makes flashbacks really work, I think, in general. I mean, I think the ones that are rooted in a character's perspective are the ones that work really well. The ones that are just revealing information can be done really well, but they're less kind of gritty and strong and powerful, I would say.
Was there, again, I don't like putting people on the spot, but did you watch films that kind of played with the times?
No,
at all?
A little bit.
But one of the obviously, you know, major films of the last 25 years that played with that was, Tarantino.
Oh, sure.
And Pulp Fiction was.
Well, that's super, super smart and clever and operating on a whole nother.
And it's showier. Much showier in saying, look how fancy we are with the editing here.
Right.
I don't even know who edited that film. That's how huge Tarantino is as far as maybe he did it. I don't remember. I should know that. But
it was his long-term editor who worked on all those films, Sally Menke.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Who's incredible.
Yeah.
Who he speaks very highly of and says it's integral to the process, you know. Often says that he writes these scripts alone and then he shoots them and then he writes them with Sally.
Well, that's the truth, right? Like an editor is retelling the story, right? There's different phases of paper to film, and the editor is hugely key in that regard, right? I mean, obviously.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's I love about it. I mean,
those are the projects you want to work on. I assume you know, you might be like hired to be more of a technician, not a storyteller.
Right. Well, definitely. I mean, what I love about it is the puzzle of how to reveal information, how to tell these stories. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's my favorite part of the whole process, I would say. I like films that are more challenging on that level, for sure. I mean, that's the great thing about documentaries, is that as an editor, you have a lot more control, a lot more to do with how the story is told.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been really lucky in my, you know, career to be able to do both and to be able to, I mean, I think that there's a lot of differences and there's a lot of similarities, so it's fun in that way.
And now more than ever, it seems as though documentaries and narrative films are having a dialogue in the way that, in other words, they're really influencing each other. We see a lot of narrative films that are shot pretty much documentary style. I mean, that's probably to the point where it's maybe too much, but I don't know. But and then we see a lot of obviously documentaries that are definitely like I had a guy on recently, he's a documentary screenwriter and I was like, well, really, what are we talking about? What is that? Is that the guy that writes the voiceover? Yes, but it's also, he literally says that they transcribe the entire documentary and then they treat it as though it's a script and then they put it together and assemble that in a way that's like a narrative film. So it's to build the arc and all these other dramatic, cinematic.
Yeah, I mean, it's revealing information. It's all revealing information. That it's, when you boil it down to its simplest, you know, it's like documentary narrative. It's all just like, you know, it's all just keeping the audience on the edge of their seat, keeping them wanting more. You know.
Yeah. What were you guys watching? I mean, were you close? I know you were.
Rosemary's Baby. We watched. Was this, I remember for
anticipating which
Martha Marcy May Marlene.
Okay, go ahead. Finish your. That's good. Keep talking.
Yeah.
Because. I'm always curious about that, obviously.
I mean, that was a huge one for Sean in terms of tone, I know. And I don't want to speak too much about that. I mean, I just remember we definitely looked at that. I mean, that script was so good that, like,
yeah.
It was, and her performance was so incredible that, you know,
which
everybody
film are you referring
film,
to
Martha.
Now? Okay. Yeah, you're totally right about that.
And,
yeah.
I mean, everybody in that film, the performances were, so it was all there, and it was beautifully shot, and
yeah.
And so it was all there. The main challenge of that was that it was a really insane time crunch when that film shot, like, August, September, and then premiered at Sundance the following January, so.
Wow. So you really were working.
That was why it was like, so important that I was.
You had like 3 or 4 started. Months to
yeah,
really get this.
Start to finish, yeah.
Incredible.
So that was the challenge of that.
So you knew you were getting into Sundance with that film?
We didn't know, but that was sort of the track that everybody was hoping for and pushing mm-hmm. for and going
mm-hmm.
for.
Mm-hmm. And so Rosemary's Baby was a main, as far as tone, as you said,
yeah.
a big influence on that film. And it's true, that film plays out like a horror film on a certain level.
Absolutely.
I mean, that kind of tension is created. You easily say that about it, right?
I mean, that was the whole thing, the keeping the tension. That was the whole challenge, and that was the whole goal always of how to, you know, we kept moving, you know, these big moments around.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an amazing lesson at some level. Like, there was a scene in there for a very long time. That I always thought of as the scariest scene in the film. You know, there's these in the present when the rocks are hitting the roof, and she's imagining that the people are outside, the cult or whatever you mm-hmm. want to say, the group that's come after her outside. There was a scene in the film where she got up, went outside, and was there and in the against mm-hmm. the black of the night, and you know, scream, "Just do it already," or something like that, and just silence, you know. And it was terrifying. And in the end of the day, at the last minute, we kind of removed, and so the film would play, and it would build and build and build and build and build to that scene, and then some, it would sort of break the tension. And it was only when we removed that scene
mm-hmm.
that we were able to keep this sort of simmer going towards the party, which is that climax at the end. So it was a really interesting lesson of, like, removing information rather than... And it was a hard one to remove because we both loved it. And it was amazingly shot. And it's a super scary moment and a great scene. And she was great in it. And but, yeah, it was only when we removed it that whole second half of the film started to, like, work better.
Yeah. That's got to be difficult to sacrifice.
Yeah, but when the film's working, you're
then
like, hey,
right.
It's easy to remember why I had to go.
Yeah, are you good or bad, or are you? I should rephrase that. Are you good? Is that a strength of yours to to make those kinds of choices?
I mean, I think that's the job on a lot of levels.
I guess
you're the only mm-hmm. one that kind of. I mean, you are brought in as the voice of reason on some level, you know.
So it doesn't come to, real sort of challenging each other.
It's hard, yeah.
Can you get down into it and arguing? And
absolutely.
I don't mean where voices are raised even, but just that, like, where you're really kind of going
absolutely.
For a long
I
time
think
on this.
You try, first of all, you know, the act of editing, you're spending a lot of time together in a very small space. You know, so
yeah,
and I think that's great. I really love the relationship between a director and editor.
Right.
It was very intimate, and you get to know each other really well. And
mm-hmm.
I really like that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like, there are definitely moments of there's highs and lows. I mean, with anything, but editing especially, I think there are moments that are incredibly high when it seems like you're really figuring it out and you're solving these problems. It's working. And
and
creative, and then there's moments that are just terrible where you're like, I do not know what to do, you know.
Yeah, you reach the end of your rope in a way,
and
creatively.
And you guys are not, or you know, the director and editor are not agreeing on what to do to solve the problem. They may not even be agreeing on what the problem is, and you can feel like nowhere, you know.
Yeah, right.
And so I think you go through but I also think those days are necessary
mm-hmm.
because then. You know, the next day you come in, you're like, all right, you know, you might have this, you know, this break.
You've built enough of an experiential palette to know that, okay, there's always been a way out of this. We just haven't found it yet.
Can't see it yet.
Yeah, yeah. but it'll present itself. We'll figure it out.
I mean, I always say that the hardest thing about editing is like just sitting there for the length of time that it takes to do it. But if you just commit that to the idea that you're not getting up until this thing is as good as it possibly can be, you know what I mean? Eventually, the editing gods like shine down on you, and somehow you figure out what.
Yeah,
how to put this thing together.
Are there any directors that you've worked with, and you don't have to name them necessarily, but that have taken more of a laissez-faire approach? They want you to kind of just work, do the editing? And
I mean, I think the directors have all sorts of different kind of processes.
Yeah. How many films have you worked on? Primary
how
editor?
How many narrative films?
No, just
films?
Roughly. I mean, are you talking about like 20? Or
No. Seven, maybe?
Oh, yeah?
Like that.
Oh, so very,
eight maybe.
Mm-hmm. Right, and then obviously as a assistant director, or have you done any directing?
Some short films and mm-hmm. music videos, mm-hmm. but nothing.
Is that something you're looking to do?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping to do a little bit more directing and mm-hmm. writing, and you mm-hmm. know, get into that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, within. I mean, I don't know what the borderline. If that's a company where that's you're within that scope, maybe you can do something with them. I don't know. Or if this is.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, we'll see what happens.
I guess I was going to ask you if you had a preference, like that intimate relationship where you're really working as a team in the editing room, and if that's something you prefer. And the experiences that come out of that seem maybe they're more fulfilling.
I mean, well, the documentaries that I've worked on, I've been much more involved on a conceptual level, because you kind of have to be as the mm-hmm. editor, and I've had really great experiences doing that. I'm not really answering your question, probably. So you're wondering if I prefer. It's a good question.
Well, I'm assuming there's probably pros and cons of. Being at the cockpit or whatever, solo, uh-huh. Flying solo in a way. I don't know how much experience you have of that, or, if that collaboration in the editing room with the director. I mean,
it's
almost everybody I've heard of.
It's not, yeah. I mean, you never really.
No matter how many hours they're sitting there at your side, or if it's they want to see what you put out and then they have notes and that kind of thing.
Totally.
It's going to be a collaboration.
It's always the director be a collaboration. And at times, it's a lonely kind of job. I mean, even when the director's there every day, I mean, it's a lot. It's very solo on some level.
Yeah.
But no, it's always a team, and I like that a lot about. I mean, I think most
yeah.
movies in general, no matter what your role is it's like a team effort. You know what I mean? And that's a big part of why making movies is fun.
Sure. Do you feel like, though, that in the general scheme of audiences and, people, the average person, they don't think about the editor as much? Or maybe,
people don't understand what producers do.
No.
People don't understand what...
Right.
I mean,
right.
People that don't work in movies don't understand how movies are made, really.
Right.
You know what I mean?
There's the unsung aspects of that business, and not many people understand that a particular producer may be working as many hours, if not more, on a film than a director, for instance.
And there are a lot
from soup to nuts, and they're working way after the film's been finished, and it's now they're focusing on the festivals, and we're focusing on distribution and all these things.
Absolutely,
on and on.
Absolutely, and a lot of producers have a very creative impact on the films as well.
Sure.
Right. And a lot. I think if you're in the movie business to become well known, then you're in for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's whatever role you have. I mean, it's never really been important to me.
It's the film.
It's telling stories, and that's how what it should be. When it's at its best, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. Anything coming up?
I'm editing a film called Bleed for This, mm-hmm. which is directed by Ben Younger, stars Miles Teller and Aaron Eckhart. It's a boxing movie. It's a narrative. It just sold to Open Road at Cannes based on a 12-minute pitch reel.
Okay. And is Miles Teller playing a young boxer?
Yes. Okay. Plays a young boxer. Is based on a true story. The young boxer's name is Vinny Pazienza.
Uh-huh.
And it's early 90s. It takes place in the early 90s. And it's about a boxer who gets in a car accident, breaks his neck, and then makes a comeback.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's a fun. It's been a lot of fun. I mean, it's a dark story at times, but mm-hmm. it's also a story of...
Eckhart, you know, plays what, his manager?
His coach.
His coach,
yeah.
It's hard to see. Incredible. It's a long way from Meredith...
You'll see, Eckhart. You'll have an opinion.
Yeah, has he changed his look?
He has.
Well, Miles Teller seems to be mild on the subject. He seems to be an actor who's definitely been in this tradition. You know, he's transforming for roles. I mean, you know, Whiplash was obviously a transformation from the prior work he did, and right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's incredible. I mean, yeah. I it's been a pleasure to be able to watch his dailies, and I mean that absolutely mm-hmm. sincerely. It mm-hmm. really is. I think he's incredible.
Now, are you currently editing that?
Yeah,
I am. It's all locked up. So they're just going to go for. They're just going to have screenings probably at Sundance, but it's.
I don't know what the. I have no idea what the distribution plan is going to be.
Yeah.
But we're I don't know, like 3 weeks away, 4 weeks away from Picture Lock. So it's a fun place to be. You know, mm-hmm. it's like the movie is 85-90% there. The movie is what the movie's going to be. And now it's just kind of this last little push to see how to really turn up the volume on this stuff.
Mm.
You know, I feel like you make these movies in the editing is like, it happens in stages often. And it's so interesting because towards the end of the process, you have like, you know, the changes that you're making are instrumental but incremental. You know, they're very small. And you go right from that to starting another thing when it feels almost hopelessly impossible that, you know, the mountain that you have to climb, the amount of footage that you're digesting mm-hmm. at that point is so different. Mm-hmm. And so, but I always go into every project being like, I'm going to get the assembly together just so much faster. I just have to run towards that assembly, you know. And of course, it takes as long as it's going to take every time. But
yeah, there's no shortcuts for what's organic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I feel like every time I go through it, it's a lesson. But I really enjoy this part of the process when the film is sort of
together. Yeah, I know it's fine too. Because as I used to write songs, quite a few songs, and it sounds similar, the process. Because once you knew you had your song, but you just knew that, you know, now it's a matter of kind of fixing it and getting it. But the song, it's done. The hard work, you know, for it's there's the character of it.
Yeah.
And so now it's just a matter of getting it over the top and, you know, finishing it. So it's just nice and, you know, done, real finished and real, real shiny.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Well, I appreciate all the more than you're squeezing this in considering
it was
project.
An absolute pleasure. I love podcasts. I love that it's a medium that's coming back. And I think it's really cool.
Well, thanks for being on mine.
Yeah. Yeah. You're doing great work.
Thank you so much. Again, go check out editstock.com, by the way, in case you're interested. And now, finally, last up here is my conversation with two great guys. This is an exciting project to be to talk about because I always like talking about horror films. It's something that, you know, I relatively new in my on my radar as far as the kinds of films I watch. I definitely see quite a few horror films these days. I like the genre film. So this was fun to bring Larry Fessenden back on the show. I was going to wait till October, closer to Halloween, to do it, but we're still going to do it in October. So what it appears is now Larry and I are co-hosting Film Wax Radio. And also, not long ago, I met Ted Kahigan at a bar, at a film event, and we were chatting. And so when the opportunity came up to actually invite him on because of his new film, We Are Still Here, I jumped at the chance. And so this is Larry's axe in the movie. He has a role, a very unforgettable role. I would give you a synopsis of the film, but there's no point because we talk about the film in somewhat in great detail. So let's just jump into the conversation. This is my conversation again with Larry Fessenden and Ted Gehagen.
Told you all about the Dagmars, huh?
Yes, that was the family who first lived here, right?
We had heard it was a funeral parlor around the turn of the century. Don't say.
Old Dagmar had been running the bodies and burying empty coffins. Some even said he was selling to the Orientals over in Boston, turning them into chop suey. Wasn't long after that that the trouble began. Just accept it. You stay, you satisfy the darkness.
You guys have moved in to one weird fucking town.
So we're here with the Ted Gehagen and Larry Fessenden, and we are still here.
We sure are.
Is the name of the film. Ted, is this your first feature? No, it's not your first feature, is it?
My first feature is director.
As a director. So yeah. You were producing or writing. What were you
both
doing?
Both. Mm-hmm. Yep. For 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, I started out in 2001 working in some German underground gore movies that somehow managed to parlay into some work in America. It was pre-digital revolution, before everyone was making movies. So I think I gratefully had my name on the IMDb a few years before everyone else, and I somehow managed to turn that into a few more jobs.
In other words, not being a Johnny Come Lately or a...
Yes.
But the other projects you worked on, were they also genre films?
Yeah, pretty much across the board. I'm just in love with horror, sci-fi, and fantasy. Like, that's...
Has that always been the case?
Yeah, since I was very, very young. I grew up in rural Montana, where there's not a whole lot
said
to do. Yes, so
yeah.
you need an escape.
Yeah. Do you have any memories of some of the... Not to put you on the spot, but tell me your favorite film.
I'm a huge fan of Lucio Fulci's House by the Cemetery, which my film owes a lot to.
Mm-hmm.
I just really love a lot of the Euro horror that was coming out. Argento's Tenebrae is one of my favorites. Just, I feel like that was the time in which Europe was just destroying it with genre stuff. It was just so fantastic. And I mean, there was some wonderful stuff that I think came out in late 70s, early 80s in the U.S. I mean, Texas Chainsaw, Dawn of the Dead, like, those are phenomenal movies. But I think my love tends to lay in that Euro horror.
Yeah, the giallo films? Did you watch those too? Or
yeah, I mean, Tenebrae is a giallo. That was kind of, you know, Argento's thing for a long time, which, you know, they're essentially like crime novels. It's like, you know, gloved hands reaching out of the darkness and killing people. And then, you know, it started out as like murder mysteries, and then they kind of just turned them into horror films because I think they just work well. And when slasher films started becoming a thing, I think giallos fit in really well with them because, again, it's kind of like the whodunit, like 10 Little Indians sort of story.
Mm-hmm. Not to jump too far ahead, but I assume you were introduced to Larry's films here.
I was introduced to Larry's films in Montana. I got a VHS of Habit, I want to say in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And just fell in love with it, and then, you know, I'd followed up on everything that he did, and I was working in a video store when Wendigo came out, and I remember we had one copy of it, and it was always rented out at our video store, because it's like, in Montana, anything that's vaguely Native American is extremely popular.
Oh, is that
and
right?
So it was like the word Wendigo, like everyone wanted it. So it reached the point where I was managing the video store, and I called up and I like ordered like 10 more copies of it. So all of your Wendigo money apparently went to Crazy Mike's Video in Missoula, Montana.
But and then I realized, I actually at the time I didn't even realize it was from the same director as Habit, and this connection kind of formed. And when I got out here, I was just very, very eager to meet him. Mm-hmm. And we apparently became friends. Apparently.
How does that strike you, Larry?
It's such a charming story to hear things like that, especially the VHS component and the idea of a video store, all the things that I grew up on as well. Mm-hmm. I even older than Ted, I think. And so I grew up, my menu of films came from TV. There was no video when I was little, so I grew up on the Universal films and the old black and whites, Frankenstein, Wolfman, the traditional studio sure. films. And then that morphed into a love of Night of the Living Dead and the films that seemed to react to that. And then into the more visceral horror, though I was more oriented towards American movies when I finally could go to the theater and see, you know, Halloween and The Exorcist. It was very thrilling. And, of course, Texas Chainsaw, mm-hmm. all the way up to Henry. Like, so there are these touchstones for me. I think I always preferred the less poppy. I never liked the 80s Nightmare on Elm Street. And it's funny, those are the things that most of the kids that I work with now, that's
reference.
Their touchstone. So right. It's fun to be different. And but I'm very charmed by Ted's story of the video store, because I eventually grew into one of those VHS. You know, you'd go to the...
Sure.
Even in New York, there were the video store was just part of the pharmacy, and you know, you'd go and find yeah. the creepiest films, like The Town That Dreaded Sundown and all these kind of skanky, slightly gritty unpleasantnesses, and they were the real treasures and the cover art and the whole thing. And to have my movies come out as VHSs was a great thrill. And
you must have known, though, like that making films that can, like, they probably never made very much money, or, you know, were you thinking about the living, making a living? It seemed they were very for a specific audience like yourself, who really wanted to find, make something that was very specific, very going to be really appreciated by a certain crowd.
Well, when I was younger, I must admit I didn't have a life strategy like that. You know, you made films because you couldn't help yourself, and you were I mean, my parents were very traditional. There was no real mechanism to break into showbiz. It's just something that I wanted to do. There was no Sundance Film Festival when I was little. It just started in the 90s, and yeah. I'd already been obsessed with films through the 80s and trying to make them. I discovered video early on, so I do feel like I was something of a pioneer. I realized you can make narratives with video, and it'll be in sync, and you can shoot hours of footage. So I did have, I mean, I was part of this new generation on the one hand, but most of my features were in celluloid, and it was a great adventure trying to figure out how to be an indie filmmaker. There was no roadmap, as there is now. It doesn't make it any easier, because I think there's so many more
as Ted was saying.
Competition and so on. But I think you can conceive of making a living now in the media, whereas when I was young, it was a complete mystery. And it was Fellini and Orson Welles and all these strange stories. And then there was George Romero, and that was such an incredible story that he made an indie film outside of the system. And but of course, even his story, and sadly, didn't have the copyright, and he didn't make the money that that film garnered for somebody. So I've been following in that tradition.
Your film is called We Are Still Here.
Correct.
Right? Which definitely is a nod towards a lot of horror film, I guess, tropes, we call them, where there's a house with some pissed off former residents in the basement. Maybe I shouldn't even say that.
No, that's fair game.
Is it?
Yep.
It's pretty early on.
That's in the trailer.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
You
good.
See the ghosts in the trailer. Okay. We're good.
All righty. So you were definitely nodding to a lot of other films that you'd seen in the past, obviously.
Yeah.
By doing something like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the idea behind it was to make a modern haunted house film, mm-hmm. but to embrace a lot of the concepts that modern films don't embrace. Things that I grew up loving about 70s and 80s cinema, like there's a certain amount of melodrama to it. You know, there's a lot more questions than answers, you know, that in We Are Still Here, nothing gets wrapped up tidily at the end. Like it very much is an open-ended film that kind of allows audiences to have a discussion afterward about what was that all about? What, you know, what did we just experience? And I feel like the majority of modern films, they make such a point, especially in like the final act, to like explain everything, explain the motivation, explain how to defeat the bad guy, like across the board, so that when you're done with the film, there are no questions whatsoever. It's just, it's over. And part of the idea with this was to do something where it is a little open-ended and it does leave you wondering. And hopefully those questions don't take away from the enjoyment one has from the film. And it just kind of fosters a discussion when it's over.
Where'd you screen it? With festivals?
It world premiered at South by Southwest, and it's played Boston Underground and a few others. And then I'm going to Brazil later today for the international premiere at Fantaspoa. And then we're going to be playing a few more fests after that. We were just announced to be at Fright Fest as well in the UK.
Oh, terrific. So,
yes. I hope I'm going. Yes.
Larry, you going? Do you go to these things just for the fun of it ever?
No.
Do you have the time? You don't have the time to do that. Yeah.
I mean, I got to say, Fright Fest is an absolute joy.
Yeah.
But I try to avoid leaving my house as much as possible.
Is that from the demand or... or is it personal decision?
No, because I'm afraid of the outdoors.
Oh, very good.
Well, I will walk two blocks to the bar.
But should dare I ask where people can find you? So you reached out to Larry. You've met him over time, and then you wrote this part. Did you write it with him? I'm going to guess you wrote it with him in mind.
I did, yeah. I wrote
the film. The film takes place in the 70s, I guess?
It does. It's set... in 1979, although it's kind of an ambiguous 1979. People ask, I say it's set during my childhood. Mm-hmm. It's those color schemes and those personalities that I remember very fondly from my youth. Mm-hmm. That's when it's set. But I had written the role of Anne for Barbara Crampton, who's also a friend of mine, and then the role of Jacob for Larry, and had just crossed my fingers that if I was ever to secure financing, whoever produced this thing would go with my picks for those two. And then the rest of it was just through open casting, you know, and we found the rest of the cast based on performances we'd seen of them in the past that we really enjoyed and people who just reached out.
Where does it take place?
It was shot in upstate New York, right outside of Rochester. Mm-hmm. It is set in kind of an undisclosed New England sleepy town. The name of the town is never said in the film, but there are some newspaper clippings during the end credits that reveal that the town's name is Islesbury, which is a reference to H.P. Lovecraft. There's subtle Lovecraft references throughout the film. There's a point where the town elder, Dave McCabe, says that the previous owners were selling corpses to the university over in Essex County, and that's Miskatonic University from Reanimator and from beyond. It was set in Essex County. So there's little nods to Lovecraft fans who might know a bit more than other folks, but it's not overly steeped in it.
Yeah. Something about shooting upstate, right? It just seems to be a place where there's tons of filming going on.
Yeah, I loved it up there. It was an amazing experience. Like the town that we shot in, there were two towns called Palmyra and Shortsville, and they were both so supportive and so just gung-ho about making this movie. And Palmyra is the birthplace of the Mormon religion, and our hotel was actually on the Sacred Grove, which is their holiest of holy places.
I knew it. I could just...
So,
The Mormon religion was founded, or I get what's the term?
Yeah, it was...
You know, started upstate New York.
Yes,
just hatched.
The angel Moroni appeared to Joseph Smith and gave him the golden tablets in Palmyra, New York.
Wow!
And then he was swiftly kicked out of there and traveled America until he found a big dead body of water that he could live by.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And so you brought up all your actors. You say there's a couple of folks that had to come in. Did you any locals get involved? I guess
The folks in the bar were all locals, as well as Maddie, the bartender, who kind of turns out to be a real tough cookie toward the end of the movie. That's Susan Gibney, who's best known. She was on Star Trek Next Generation, and she was the love interest for Geordi LaForge on that show. She was Dr. Leah Brahms, so for any Trekkies. And
it's my biggest demographic, I think.
Is it? Oh, perfect.
Yeah. Good luck.
Yes. Yeah. But she had actually retired from acting and was just living in Rochester. And they reached out to her, and she was just really excited, thought it sounded fun and liked the script. And, you know, it's kind of a minimal role. I think she was there for 3 days and had fun and, you know, got to freak out and get bloody. So I think she had a good time.
So a big part of the film is the blood and gore.
Yes.
There's quite a bit. Depending how you look at it, it sort of devolves or, you know, sort of grows into a great amount of gore. And I'm just wondering, like, how much work is involved in creating that? And like
a massive
amount. And who are you working? Like, give, like, people that don't know what that is, you know, most indie films, you know, people sitting around the table talking.
Yeah.
But this is where, you know, there's a lot of effects here, a lot of makeup, a lot of...
Starting kind of at the beginning of the third act... During the seance sequence, things start to get pretty crazy.
Larry swallows.
Yeah, exactly. Larry does swallow
a sweat sock.
Yes,
the biggest horror, I think, of the whole thing.
Well, that's that as well as every
spoiler alert there.
Yes, yeah. Larry's a sock. it was all done practically. There's no CGI in the film, even for some of the gags that it looks like there's CGI for. Mm-hmm. There's a mild amount of computer-generated effect around the Dagmar family. There's like little embers that kind of rise off their bodies and things like that. We added a heat signature to them to make them feel a little hotter. Mm-hmm. But really, the Dagmar family, as well as all the gore, was all done practically. Mm-hmm. It was done by an effects team based out of Tampa, Florida, called Autopsy Effects. And the guy who runs that is a fellow named Marcus Cook, who's been a really dear friend of mine for over a decade. He's worked with me on a lot of films that I've either written or produced, and I've just helped bring him on board. And with this, I just knew how crazy the end of the film was going to get, and I wanted someone who I'd worked with before and was a friend, you know, especially, you know, on a film like this where it's my first time directing a feature. It helps more than words can say to have people you can count on like Marcus and Larry and Barbara.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because I'm thinking, Larry, you've done at least two or three horror films, I believe. Well, I was going to ask you this, but since you got the mic now, you're brought in purely for your, you know, remarkable acting skills. Don't laugh at that. That's you're very good in anything you do and everything you do. But this was I've seen you in about a dozen horror films probably. Right? So how do you have to kind of like keep in check yourself in check, like if you want to, or was there a large amount of participation?
I spoke up now and again, but I do want to paint a picture of the set that was so lovely. Dude. It's that was produced by, at least on the ground, Travis Stevens, who's, I think, a pal of Ted's, and provided sort of almost a big brotherly role. But in any case, as a producer, he was very hands-on, and it was lovely to see him at the monitor and really coming and advising Ted, and they had their rapport. And then there was Kareem Hussein, who was the DP, and he's an encyclopedic mind of horror cinema as movies in general, and he was, I think, a great collaborator as well. And then there were the actors, and we all felt very at home with each other. We bonded quickly, and really the whole set was very cozy and pleasant, even though we were dealing with very dark subjects, including the loss of a kid, which is very painful for any parent.
Yeah.
And Barbara was taking that seriously and really gave a very earnest performance. So there was an element of sadness, but it was just generally a lot of fun. And I always say in interviews that that comes from the top down. And Ted just set a very collaborative, pleasant, enthusiastic environment. And everybody then follows suit. And this is the key to directing. You can be a tyrant as well. That's another approach. But Ted's approach was to be very inclusive. And I think it made for you know, he got the best out of everybody, of course, including the effects guys. And as for me coming in as a muck-a-muck and a filmmaker and stuff, I spoke up now and again just because you get into the heat of the moment. You say, well, dudes, what if
yeah,
that
sure.
should be over like this? I actually can claim one thing. Mm-hmm. There's a great thing at the end. I don't think I'm giving much away to say there's some mayhem and people being held up in the corner of the room. And in my opinion, they weren't being held up high enough because you couldn't see the gore. So I stepped in and said, come on, guys, you know, throw them up on a ladder. So whenever I see that, I think, ah, yes, my own stamp on the picture. But I didn't. I try not to talk too much because, you know,
yeah, sure.
being an actor is a humbling experience, and you want to mm-hmm. listen more than talk and see what the director wants and sort of get the cues, whether they're admitting it or not. If they're not getting what they want, you have to really be attentive and try to deliver. So it's its own job. You don't need to wear too many hats when you get there just for that role.
Sure, sure. Since you made a couple of references to storyline, the rest, I guess, of the setup would be to this couple, middle-aged couple, have just recently lost a child and have decided to move upstate to go through their mourning period, grieving, and just to change things up and to get away from that. And they move into this house that is in New England, ostensibly. And then all mayhem ensues, as we discussed.
Yes.
The prior residents, it's every 30 years,
yes,
decide to come back and collect their mail.
Yes, exactly.
Check the furnace.
Yes.
Things like that.
Yes, know. They do. But, yeah, no, they, you know, they when they move into this house, they, you know, they for, at first believe the presence may be their son that they brought with them.
Oh, right.
But as...
There's always hope.
Yes. As the film progresses, they begin to believe that it may be something much older and darker. So they call upon their new agey friends who they think might be able to figure this out a little bit easier than they are, and bring up Jacob and May, who are Larry Fessenden and Lisa Marie, mm-hmm. To try to figure it out. And, you know, as the movie progresses, even once we're aware of the fact that there is this much darker presence in the house, there's always still hope throughout the film that Bobby, their son, is also there with them. And that current kind of runs throughout the film literally until the final shot. And, you know, I don't feel like I'm giving anything away by saying that I really want the audience, I'd like that to be a discussion point when the film is over as to whether Bobby was really there with them throughout mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. entire film or not. So, yeah, it's up in the air.
Well, I appreciate something you just sort of said, Larry, too, that I think a lot of films are so quick to dispose of children without getting on a pulpit or anything about it. But I do. I think a lot of films dispose of children, whether they're actually a part of the cast or not. Well, we lost a kid, you know, so now we can move ahead with the story. But to actually honor that there are many people who lose, you know, children in their family, and it's more than just an instigator for a plot.
Well,
you know, being a dad myself.
Yeah.
Of a kid named Jacob, as it turns out. As
oh.
it is. Yeah.
Well, certainly. I think the real key to interesting horror, and something that's been lost from certainly a lot of Hollywood's recent efforts, but even the mini studios and the things mm-hmm. that we're seeing on the big screens distributed very aggressively, is a sense of real loss. And having violence is always fun in a movie, but... to have it count, and I think that's where indie films can still be vital and
yeah.
actually remind people of the storylines and why horror is a mechanism to talk about dark things, even in a show that's fun in the end, like Ted. So, I mean, I always say I take horror quite seriously, and I think it's a way to explore some of the darker, melancholy aspects of life and not to gloss over it. And I think there are certain movies out there that are just approaching film as an entertainment only, and they,
it's a missed opportunity.
It is. It's well put, because in the end, you don't engage with them in the same way. And I'd rather put the audience through a bit of discomfort and then release and then further discomfort. It's like Ted says, you don't answer every question. You're left
right.
with some unanswered things, and that means that you're going to take that and discuss it, and you don't forget it right away. That's the problem with tying things up in a bow. It's sort of the
yeah.
catharsis happens. What you want to do is leave audiences questioning and wondering and hopefully opening their minds to the mysteries of life and so on. I just had the misfortune of seeing Poltergeist, and it was fun because
the reboot.
It reminded me,
or whatever.
I don't know. It's a remake. It's not a reboot. Yeah. God help us. But it's interesting to see that movie because, of course, the origin was the original Poltergeist, which did plant a flag and make some new ideas. And the idea of it's always credited to Spielberg, but the point is that sort of Spielbergian thing of putting ghosts into the suburbs. So there's some interesting ideas in the original, of course. And now we have lived with Insidious and all of those franchise. And then to see a Poltergeist remake is just, it's a strange amalgam of old, tired, been there, done that. And then, yeah. But what I'm talking about it for is that it also reminded me ultimately of Ted's movie and how much more exciting it is to see We Are Still Here. If one wants to get a little competitive at the box office, I think you'll have a better time because there's surprises and there's some earnestness and there's some, what we started by talking about, there's some real pain from which the story comes. And actually, it's not just Barbara's sadness over losing her son, it's the indignation of the backstory,
right,
and where these ghosts are, have a bit of an axe to grind. And, so there's a lot going on, and you realize, you know, the world is complex, and there's, I mean, you could take it further and say, you know, things have a cause and effect, and you can't just run a family out of town and think you're done with it. You know, we're all haunted. I think that's what's exciting about horror and haunted films, is to show, yeah, these stories stay with us. Actions have consequences.
It's also, turns out this week, I think also Human Centipede 3 was also
came out. I believe that is correct.
We can gloss over that, though. I don't think any conversations came as a result of that film, after that film, because nobody made it through, probably, is my guess. No disrespect. No disrespect. It's a kind of cynical way of making film. We Are Still Here is, which is a good name because people will still be there at the end of that.
That's
movie.
What we hope, yeah. Yes.
No, for sure. And that's opens?
Yeah. It actually opens June 5th.
June 5th.
It's going to be opening at the Cinema Village in New York.
Very good.
And then it's also available on all VOD platforms, cable, iTunes, Amazon, all that good stuff. So. Yeah. But
see
but
the theater.
Try to see it in the theater.
Well, if you're in New York, come to the Cinema Village. But if you guys will both be there,
I will. I don't know. I don't know if Larry's going to read it. I'll twist his arm. So
it's a little bit. It's a little bit further than two blocks from where your place, but not much more. Talking to the mic. Make jokes.
I will be planning my trip. I've got a Google Map. Up to 12th Street from my house.
Oh, very good.
I don't like to use Uber, so I'm wondering if I could get a cab. Or I could walk, but I might need some.
You can get one of those city bikes, Citibank bikes, too.
That's
bike
true.
Over. That'd be a first.
It would.
No
I
comments,
do have huh? a bike, though.
Oh, you do?
Well, I used to. I'm in the market for a bike. But we don't need to get into that.
So if you're listening and you have a bike that is in good shape, not haunted.
Larry's looking.
You want a haunted bike? Actually, that probably would suit you pretty well.
But yeah, it's we're excited. Yeah, it's I'm very excited to have the film opening theatrically. It plays very well to an audience. I've discovered it feels like a very different film when you see it in a crowded room on the big screen.
Sure.
There's even the big screen allows for some of the very slight nuances that not only I put into it, but the actors, the special effects, and Kareem. There's some things that I think you might miss seeing it on the little screen. So, any opportunity you have to see it big, please do. And it's opening in L.A. and a few other cities. So,
I wanted you to mention that, too, if it's opening in L.A., because there are some...
It is, yeah. It's absolutely opening. It's the same day, so it'll be on the 5th as well. And it's got a few other markets it's going to be popping up in. I believe Portland and or Seattle, somewhere along there. It's all on the official website. So, I'm really excited for folks to hopefully see it on the big screen. If not, I think it does play as a very fun movie on VOD, too. It's a... stay up late, pop some popcorn, and, you know, kind of pretend it's one of those films that you hopefully grew up watching on VHS.
Yeah. Don't burn the popcorn, though.
Yes, exactly. It'll be a little too real.
There's enough
Exactly. So there's enough charred bodies in the film.
Well, Ted, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, the website. Yeah, I was. Sure. That's. I liked it. I'm trying to remember it right off the top of my head. I believe it's wearestillheremovie.com. But
Google
Google We Are Still Here, I promise it's there. Also, we've got a Facebook page and Twitter account, so just search for us on any of those, and all that information is up there as well. So yeah,
Google that and Google the map to Cinema Village.
And Google a map to Cinema Village, yes. And we'll most certainly be there on. I'll be there the 5th and 6th for sure. And hopefully we'll have a few other members of the cast pop in.
Well, excellent.
So it should be a lot of fun.
Well, Ted, thanks for coming on the podcast. Thank you.
I'm very happy to be here.
Larry, thank you for returning to the podcast. I was going to, you can respond to my thank you first, but I was going to also invite you now in a quasi-public way. I was going to say, yeah, I was thinking originally of inviting you back toward the end of October. Mm-hmm. As like maybe a regular thing where we could do a something.
That'd be great.
Leading up to Halloween on every year.
Big October for me. It's the 30th anniversary of Glass Eye Picks, my little company.
Really?
And we've got lots of fantastic new products and fun things all to be announced in the next couple of months. And then all to drop on October. So my new slogan for the fans is, start saving now. Because there's lots to...
You're selling shares of Glass Eye Picks.
Yes. There's lots of new merch.
Oh, very good. Celebrating
so it'd be
30
great
years.
To,
congratulations.
To hop on the radio with you.
Yeah, let's do that.
And I'll remind sell you. The wares.
I'll definitely remind you of that.
Thanks.
But congratulations, 30 years. All right, guys. Thanks so much. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can go to, iTunes and subscribe to FilmWax Radio. Please, again, leave a star rating, a comment. You can like the Facebook page if you go to facebook.com/FilmWax Radio. You can join our Twitter feed at FilmWax Radio. You can join our Instagram account or whatever, friends. You can go to our website and get on the mailing list. You can do all sorts of stuff like that. And, be involved, engaged with all things FilmWax Radio. We are, as you can see, approaching the 300th episode. But I just want to tell you, in the next few episodes, we have Nathan Silver returning, I think, for his third visit. So it's going to be his three-peat episode. As I'm posting the show, Nathan's film, On Certain Terms, it's not his most recent, it's his last film. On Certain Terms is currently playing in New York City theatrically. It is Stinking Heaven is his brand new film, which is actually, if you're in New York, going to be at Spam Cinema Fest and in the next couple of weeks. And we're going to talk about that film and everything else. Nathan's a friend, and I'm looking forward to bringing him on. We have also coming up in the next couple of episodes. Oh, this is crazy. I meant to talk about this at the beginning of the show, but I'll just get into it next time. Jason Schwartzman. Holy crap. Jason Schwartzman's on the show. This is someone I was pursuing the last few weeks. It finally came about. He just screened one of his two brand new films at Rooftop Films the other day. It was called Seven Chinese Brothers. That may sound familiar to my regular listeners because I had the director on when I was at South by Southwest, Bob Byington. It's his new comedy starring Jason Schwartzman. Jason's also in another terrific film by the filmmaker Patrick Bryce, and that is called The Overnight. And Jason's in that as well as Taylor Schilling, Adam Scott, and it's a great film. It's a great comedy. I really loved it. I think it premiered at Sundance. I saw it at Tribeca Film Festival and was completely blown away by it. So to talk to Jason Schwartzman, and we have a couple of special guests on that segment coming up. And we'll put that up in just a couple of weeks since The Overnight comes out on June 19th, I believe. David Gordon Green is back for his three-peat episode. He's going to be on also because Manglehorn, starring Al Pacino and Holly Hunter and Chris Messina and Harmony Korine, is about to come out, and that is a goofy film, but it's worth your time seeing if you can. I saw it at Toronto Film Festival last fall, and now it's also opening up in just a couple of weeks. So we're going to have on David Gordon Green back for his third appearance on the podcast. Whew! And then we're going to coming up to episode number 300. Should I tell you who it is? It's a major independent filmmaker pioneer. He's been on the show before, very briefly. And he wasn't solo. It's John Sayles. very excited to announce there's going to be an hour plus long episode with John Sayles talking about his career, past and present. Met up with him in Austin, Texas, back during South by Southwest, and he spoke to me at length. He was generous and warm and funny and all those great things, and it's just all these conversations grounds me and makes me feel like, oh, this is worth my time. It's worth all the effort, the energy, the exhaustion. Anyway, thank you guys. I do have to pop out of here. I want to wrap this up. So, thank you for listening. Thank you for my new sponsor, editstock.com. Thank you to those people. And, thank you to you, for being, such a supportive listener. Again, spread the good word about Film Wax Radio. It's much appreciated. Okay. This is your host, Adam Shartoff. The name of the show is Film Wax Radio. It's presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time, take care. I still